hourglass. The clock was the official timekeeper for the nearby train station, the one from which all the other clocks that lined the platform were synchronized. The moving trains arriving from other cities, where the local time was not always standardized, would reset their own clocks by looking up at the Baron clock tower as they sped into town. So it was that Albert Einstein would end up spending the most creative 7 years of his life, even after he had written the papers that reoriented physics, arriving at work at 8 a.m. 6 days a week and examining patent applications. "I am frightfully busy," he wrote to a friend a few months later. "Every day I spend 8 hours at the office and at least 1 hour of private lessons, and then, in addition, I do some scientific work." Yet it would be wrong to think that poring over applications for patents was drudgery. "I enjoy my work at the office very much, because it is uncommonly diversified." He soon learned that he could work on the patent application so quickly that it left time for him to sneak in his own scientific thinking during the day. "I was able to do a full day's work in only 2 or 3 hours," he recalled. "The remaining part of the day, I would work out my own ideas." His boss, Friedrich Haller, was a man of good-natured, growling skepticism and genial humor, who graciously ignored the sheets of paper that cluttered Einstein's desk and vanished into his drawer when people came to see him. "Whenever anybody would come by, I would cram my notes into my desk drawer and pretend to work on my office work." Indeed, we should not feel sorry for Einstein that he found himself exiled from the cloisters of academe. He came to believe that it was a benefit to his science rather than a burden to work instead in that worldly cloister where I hatched my most beautiful ideas. Every day he would do thought experiments based on theoretical premises, sniffing out the underlying realities. "Focusing on real-life questions," he later said, "stimulated me to see the physical ramifications of theoretical concepts." Among the ideas that he had to consider for patents were dozens of new methods for synchronizing clocks and coordinating time through signals sent at the speed of light. In addition, his boss Haller had a credo that was as useful for a creative and rebellious theorist as it was for a patent examiner. "You have to remain critically vigilant. Question every premise, challenge conventional wisdom, and never accept the truth of something merely because everyone else views it as obvious. Resist being credulous. When you pick up an application," Haller instructed, "think that everything the inventor says is wrong." Einstein had grown up in a family that created patents and tried to apply them in business, and he found the process to be fulfilling. It reinforced one of his ingenious talents, the ability to conduct thought experiments in which he could visualize how a theory would play out in reality. It also helped him peel off the irrelevant facts that surrounded a problem. Had he been consigned instead to the job of an assistant to a professor, he might have felt compelled to churn out safe publications and be overly cautious in challenging accepted notions. As he later noted, originality and creativity were not prime assets for climbing academic ladders, especially in the German-speaking world, and he would have felt pressure to conform to the prejudices or prevailing wisdom of his patrons. An academic career in which a person is forced to produce scientific writings in great amounts creates a danger of intellectual superficiality, he said. As a result, the happenstance that landed him on a stool at the Swiss Patent Office, rather than as an acolyte in academia, likely reinforced some of the traits destined to make him successful: a merry skepticism about what appeared on the pages in front of him, and an independence of judgment that allowed him to challenge basic assumptions. There were no pressures or incentives among the patent examiners to behave otherwise. The Olympia Academy. Maurice Solovin, a Romanian studying philosophy at the University of Bern, bought a newspaper while on a stroll one day during Easter vacation of 1902 and noticed Einstein's advertisement offering tutorials in physics, trial lessons free. A dapper dilettante with close-cropped hair and a raffish goatee, Solovin was 4 years older than Einstein, but he had yet to decide whether he wanted to be a philosopher, a physicist, or something else. So he went to the address, rang the bell, and a moment later a loud voice thundered, "I'm here." Einstein made an immediate impression. I was struck by the extraordinary brilliance of his large eyes, so Levine recalled. Their first discussion lasted almost 2 hours, after which Einstein followed Solovine into the street, where they talked for a half hour more. They agreed to meet the next day. At the third session, Einstein announced that conversing freely was more fun than tutoring for pay. "You don't have to be tutored in physics," he said. "Just come see me when you want, and I'll be glad to talk with you." They decided to read The Great Thinkers together, and then discuss their ideas. Their sessions were joined by Konrad Habicht, a banker's son and former student of mathematics at the Zurich Polytechnic. Poking a little fun at pompous scholarly societies, they dubbed themselves the Olympia Academy. Einstein, even though he was the youngest, was designated the president, and Solovine prepared a certificate with a drawing of an Einstein bust in profile beneath a string of sausages. A man perfectly and clearly erudite, imbued with exquisite, subtle, and elegant knowledge, steeped in the revolutionary science of the cosmos, the dedication declared. Generally, their dinners were frugal repasts of sausage, Gruyere cheese, fruit, and tea. But for Einstein's birthday, Solovine and Habicht decided to surprise him by putting 3 plates of caviar on the table. Einstein was engrossed in analyzing Galileo's principle of inertia, and as he talked, he took mouthful after mouthful of his caviar without seeming to notice. Habicht and Solovine exchanged furtive glances. "Do you realize what you've been eating?" Solovine finally asked. "For goodness sake," Einstein exclaimed. "So that was the famous caviar." He paused for a moment, then added, "Well, if you offer gourmet food to peasants like me, you know they won't appreciate it." After their discussions, which could last all night, Einstein would sometimes play the violin, and in the summertime they occasionally climbed a mountain on the outskirts of Bern to watch the sunrise. The sight of the twinkling stars made a strong impression on us and led us to discussions of astronomy, Solovine recalled. We would marvel at the sun as it came slowly toward the horizon and finally appeared in all of its splendor to bathe the Alps in a mystic rose. Then they would wait for the mountain cafe to open so they could drink dark coffee before hiking down to start work. Solovine once skipped a session scheduled for his apartment because he was enticed instead to a concert by a Czech quartet. As a peace offering, he left behind, as his note written in Latin proclaimed, hard-boiled eggs and a salutation. Einstein and Habicht, knowing how much Solovine hated tobacco, took revenge by smoking pipes and cigars in Solovine's room and piling his furniture and dishes on the bed. "Thick smoke and a salutation," they wrote in Latin. Solovine says he was almost overwhelmed by the fumes when he returned. "I thought I would suffocate. I opened the window wide and began to remove from the bed the mound of things that reached almost to the ceiling." Solovine and Habicht would become Einstein's lifelong friends, and he would later reminisce with them about our cheerful academy, which was less childish than those respectable ones which I later got to know at close quarters. In response to a joint postcard sent from Paris by his 2 colleagues on his 74th birthday, he paid tribute to it. "Your members created you to make fun of your long-established sister academies. How well their mockery hit the mark I have learned to appreciate fully through long years of careful observation." The academy's reading list included some classics with themes that Einstein could appreciate, such as Sophocles' searing play about the defiance of authority, Antigone, and Cervantes' epic about stubbornly tilting at windmills Don Quixote. But mostly, the 3 academicians read books that explored the intersection of science and philosophy. David Hume's A Treatise of Human Nature, Ernst Mach's Analysis of the Sensations and Mechanics and Its Development, Baruch Spinoza's Ethics, and Henri Poincaré's Science and Hypothesis. It was from reading these authors that the young patent examiner began to develop his own philosophy of science. The most influential of these, Einstein later said, was the Scottish empiricist David Hume, 1711 to 1776. In the tradition of Locke and Berkeley, Hume was skeptical about any knowledge other than what could be directly perceived by the senses. Even the apparent laws of causality were suspect to him, mere habits of the mind. A ball hitting another may behave the way that Newton's laws predict, time after time after time. Yet that was not, strictly speaking, a reason to believe that it would happen that way the next time. Hume saw clearly that certain concepts, for example that of causality, cannot be deduced from our perceptions of experience by logical methods, Einstein noted. A version of this philosophy, sometimes called positivism, denied the validity of any concepts that went beyond descriptions of phenomena that we directly experience. It appealed to Einstein, at least initially. The theory of relativity suggests itself in positivism, he said. This line of thought had a great influence on my efforts. Most specifically Mach, and even more so Hume, whose treatise of human nature I studied avidly and with admiration, shortly before discovering the theory of relativity. Hume applied his skeptical rigor to the concept of time. It made no sense, he said, to speak of time as having an absolute existence that was independent of observable objects whose movements permitted us to define time. From the succession of ideas and impressions we form the idea of time, Hume wrote. It is not possible for time alone ever to make its appearance. This idea that there was no such thing as absolute time would later echo in Einstein's theory of relativity. Hume's specific thoughts about time, however, had less influence on Einstein than his more general insight that it is dangerous to talk about concepts that are not definable by perceptions and observations. Einstein's views on Hume were tempered by his appreciation for Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804, the German metaphysician he had been introduced to back when he was a schoolboy, by Max Talmud. Kant took the stage with an idea that signified a step towards the solution of Hume's dilemma, Einstein said. Some truths fit into a category of definitely assured knowledge that was grounded in reason itself. In other words, Kant distinguished between two types of truths. One, analytic propositions, which derive from logic and reason itself, rather than from observing the world. For example, all bachelors are unmarried, 2 plus 2 equals 4, and the angles of a triangle always add up to 180 degrees. And, two, synthetic propositions, which are based on experience and observations. For example, Munich is bigger than Bern, all swans are white. The latter could be revised by new empirical evidence, but not the former. We may discover a black swan, but not a married bachelor. Or, at least so Kant thought, a triangle with 181 degrees. As Einstein said of Kant's first category of truths, this is held to be the case, for example, in the propositions of geometry and in the principle of causality. These and certain other types of knowledge do not previously have to be gained from sense data. In other words, they are a priori knowledge. Einstein initially found it wondrous that certain truths could be discovered by reason alone. But he soon began to question Kant's rigid distinction between analytic and synthetic truths. The objects with which geometry deals seemed to be of no different type than the objects of sensory perception, he recalled, and later he would reject outright this Kantian distinction. "I am convinced that this differentiation is erroneous," he wrote. "A proposition that seems purely analytic, such as the angles of a triangle adding up to 180 degrees, could turn out to be false in a non-Euclidean geometry, or in a curved space, such as would be the case in the general theory of relativity." As he later said of the concepts of geometry and causality, "Today everyone knows, of course, that the mentioned concepts contain nothing of certainty, of the inherent necessity which Kant attributed to them." Hume's empiricism was carried a step further by Ernst Mach, 1838 to 1916, the Austrian physicist and philosopher whose writings Einstein read at the urging of Michele Besso. He became one of the favorite authors of the Olympia Academy, and he helped to instill in Einstein the skepticism about received wisdom and accepted conventions that would become a hallmark of his creativity. Einstein would later proclaim, in words that could be used about himself as well, that Mach's genius was partly due to his incorruptible skepticism and independence. The essence of Mach's philosophy was this, in Einstein's words: Concepts have meaning only if we can point to objects to which they refer, and to the rules by which they are assigned to these objects. In other words, for a concept to make sense, you need an operational definition of it, one that describes how you would observe the concept in operation. This would bear fruit for Einstein when, a few years later, he and Bessel would talk about what observation would give meaning to the apparently simple concept that two events happened simultaneously. The most influential thing that Mach did for Einstein was to apply this approach to Newton's concepts of absolute time and absolute space. It was impossible to define these concepts, Mach asserted, in terms of observations you could make. Therefore, they were meaningless. Mach ridiculed Newton's conceptual monstrosity of absolute space. He called it purely a thought thing which cannot be pointed to in experience. The final intellectual hero of the Olympia Academy was Baruch Spinoza, 1632 to 1677, the Jewish philosopher from Amsterdam. His influence was primarily religious. Einstein embraced his concept of an amorphous God, reflected in the awe-inspiring beauty, rationality, and unity of nature's laws. But like Spinoza, Einstein did not believe in a personal God who rewarded and punished and intervened in our daily lives. In addition, Einstein drew from Spinoza a faith in determinism, a sense that the laws of nature, once we could fathom them, decreed immutable causes and effects, and that God did not play dice by allowing any events to be random or undetermined. All things are determined by the necessity of divine nature, Spinoza declared. And even when quantum mechanics seemed to show that was wrong, Einstein steadfastly believed it was right. Marrying Mileva. Hermann Einstein was not destined to see his son become anything more successful than a third-class patent examiner. In October 1902, when Hermann's health began to decline, Einstein traveled to Milan to be with him at the end. Their relationship had long been a mix of alienation and affection, and it concluded on that note as well. When the end came, Einstein's assistant Helen Dukas later said, Hermann asked all of them to leave the room so he could die on his own. Einstein felt for the rest of his life a sense of guilt about that moment, which encapsulated his inability to forge a true bond with his father. For the first time, he was thrown into a daze, overwhelmed by a feeling of desolation. He later called his father's death the deepest shock he had ever experienced. The event did, however, solve one important issue. On his deathbed, Hermann Einstein gave his permission, finally, for his son to marry Mileva Maric. Einstein's Olympia Academy colleagues, Maurice Solovine and Konrad Habicht, convened a special session on January 6, 1903, to serve as witnesses at the tiny civil ceremony in the Baron Registrar's office where Albert Einstein married Mileva Maric. No family members, not Einstein's mother or sister nor Maric's parents, came to Bern. The tight group of intellectual comrades celebrated together at a restaurant that evening, and then Einstein and Maric went back to his apartment together. Not surprisingly, he had forgotten his key and had to wake his landlady. "Well, now I am a married man, and I am living a very pleasant, cozy life with my wife," he reported to Michele Besso 2 weeks later. "She takes excellent care of everything, cooks well, and is always cheerful." For her part, Maric reported to her own best friend, "I am even closer to my sweetheart, if it is at all possible, than I was in our Zurich days." Once married, she usually used the name Mileva Einstein Maric. After they were divorced, she eventually resumed using Mileva Maric. To avoid confusion, I refer to her as Maric throughout. Occasionally, she would attend sessions of the Olympia Academy, but mainly as an observer. Mileva, intelligent and reserved, listened intently but never intervened in our discussions, Solovine recalled. Nevertheless, clouds began to form. My new duties are taking their toll, Marit said of her housekeeping chores and role as a mere onlooker when science was discussed. Einstein's friends felt that she was becoming even more gloomy. At times she seemed laconic and distrustful as well. And Einstein, at least so he claimed in retrospect, had already become wary. He had felt an inner resistance to marrying Marit, he later claimed, but had overcome it out of a sense of duty. Marit soon began to look for ways to restore the magic to their relationship. She hoped that they would escape the bourgeois drudgery that seemed inherent in the household of a Swiss civil servant, and instead find some opportunity to recapture their old bohemian academic life. They decided, or at least so Marit hoped, that Einstein would find a teaching job somewhere far away, perhaps near their forsaken daughter. "We will try anywhere," she wrote to her friend in Serbia. "Do you think, for example, that in Belgrade, people of our kind could find something?" Marit said they would do anything academic, even teaching German in a high school. "You see, we still have that old enterprising spirit." As far as we know, Einstein never went to Serbia to seek a job or to see his baby. A few months into their marriage, in August 1903, the secret cloud hovering over their lives suddenly cast a new pall. Marit received word that Liesel, then 19 months old, had come down with scarlet fever. She boarded a train for Novi Sad. When it stopped in Salzburg, she bought a postcard of a local castle and jotted a note, which she mailed from the stop in Budapest. "It is going quickly, but it is hard. I don't feel well at all. What are you doing, little Johnsil? Write me soon, will you? Your poor Dolly." Apparently, the child was given up for adoption. The only clue we have is a cryptic letter Einstein wrote Marit in September, after she had been in Novi Sad for a month. "I'm very sorry about what happened with Liesel. Scarlet fever often leaves some lasting trace behind. If only everything passes well. How is Liesel registered? We must take great care, lest difficulties arise for the child in the future." Whatever the motivation Einstein may have had for asking the question, neither Liesel's registration documents nor any other paper trace of her existence is known to have survived. Various researchers, Serbian and American, including Robert Schulman of the Einstein Papers Project, and Michelle Zakheim, who wrote a book about searching for Liesel, have fruitlessly scoured churches, registries, synagogues, and cemeteries. All evidence about Einstein's daughter was carefully erased. Almost every one of the letters between Einstein and Marit in the summer and fall of 1902, many of which presumably dealt with Liesel, were destroyed. Those between Marit and her friend Helena Savic during that period were intentionally burned by Savic's family. For the rest of their lives, even after they divorced, Einstein and his wife did all they could, with surprising success, to cover up not only the fate of their first child, but her very existence. One of the few facts that have escaped this black hole of history is that Liesel was still alive in September 1903. Einstein's expression of worry in his letter to Marit that month about potential difficulties for the child in the future makes this clear. The letter also indicates that she had been given up for adoption by then because in it Einstein spoke of the desirability of having a replacement child. There are two plausible explanations about the fate of Liesel. The first is that she survived her bout of scarlet fever and was raised by an adoptive family. On a couple of occasions later in his life, when women came forward claiming, falsely it turned out, to be illegitimate children of his, Einstein did not dismiss the possibility out of hand, although given the number of affairs he had, this is no indication that he thought they might be Liesel. One possibility, favored by Schulman, is that Marit's friend Helena Savic adopted Liesel. She did, in fact, raise a daughter, Zorka, who was blind from early childhood, perhaps as a result of scarlet fever, was never married, and was shielded by her nephew from people who sought to interview her. Zorka died in the 1990s. The nephew who protected Zorka, Milan Popovich, rejects this possibility. In a book he wrote on the friendship and correspondence between Marit and his grandmother, Helena Savic, in Albert's Shadow, Popovich asserted, "A theory has been advanced that my grandmother adopted Lizaru, but an examination of my family's history renders this groundless." He did not, however, produce any documentary evidence, such as his aunt's birth certificate, to back up this contention. His mother burned most of Helena Savage's letters, including any that had dealt with Lizaru. Popovich's own theory, based partly on the family stories recalled by a Serbian writer named Mira Alekovic, is that Lizaru died of scarlet fever in September 1903, after Einstein's letter of that month. Michelle Zachheim, in her book describing her hunt for Lizaru, comes to a similar conclusion. Whatever happened added to Maric's gloom. Shortly after Einstein died, a writer named Peter Michelmore, who knew nothing of Lizaru, published a book that was based in part on conversations with Einstein's son, Hans Albert Einstein. Referring to the year right after their marriage, Michelmore noted, "Something had happened between the two, but Mileva would say only that it was intensely personal. Whatever it was, she brooded about it, and Albert seemed to be in some ways responsible." Friends encouraged Mileva to talk about her problem and get it out in the open. She insisted that it was too personal, and kept it a secret all her life, a vital detail in the story of Albert Einstein that still remains shrouded in mystery. The illness that Maric complained about in her postcard from Budapest was likely because she was pregnant again. When she found out that indeed she was, she worried that this would anger her husband. But Einstein expressed happiness on hearing the news that there would soon be a replacement for their daughter. "I'm not the least bit angry that poor Dolly is hatching a new chick," he wrote. "In fact, I'm happy about it, and had already given some thought to whether I shouldn't see to it that you get a new Lizaru. After all, you shouldn't be denied that which is the right of all women." Hans Albert Einstein was born on May 14, 1904. The new child lifted Maric's spirits and restored some joy to her marriage, or so at least she told her friend Helena Savage. "Hop over to Bern so I can see you again, and I can show you my dear little sweetheart, who is also named Albert. I cannot tell you how much joy he gives me when he laughs so cheerfully on waking up or when he kicks his legs while taking a bath." Einstein was behaving with fatherly dignity, Maric noted, and he spent time making little toys for his baby son, such as a cable car he constructed from matchboxes and string. "That was one of the nicest toys I had at the time, and it worked," Hans Albert could still recall when he was an adult. "Out of little string and matchboxes and so on, he could make the most beautiful things." Milos Maric was so overjoyed with the birth of a grandson that he came to visit and offered a sizable dowry, reported in family lore, likely with some exaggeration, to be 100,000 Swiss francs. But Einstein declined it, saying he had not married his daughter for money, Milos Maric later recounted with tears in his eyes. In fact, Einstein was beginning to do well enough on his own. After more than a year at the patent office, he had been taken off probationary status. Chapter 5. The Miracle Year. Quanta and Molecules. 1905. Turn of the century. "There is nothing new to be discovered in physics now," the revered Lord Kelvin reportedly told the British Association for the Advancement of Science in 1900. "All that remains is more and more precise measurement." He was wrong. The foundations of classical physics had been laid by Isaac Newton, 1642 to 1727, in the late 17th century. Building on the discoveries of Galileo and others, he developed laws that described a very comprehensible mechanical universe. A falling apple and an orbiting moon were governed by the same rules of gravity, mass, force, and motion. Causes produced effects. Forces acted upon objects. And in theory, everything could be explained, determined, and predicted. As the mathematician and astronomer Laplace exulted about Newton's universe, "An intelligence knowing all the forces acting in nature at a given instant, as well as the momentary positions of all things in the universe, would be able to comprehend in one single formula the motions of the largest bodies as well as the lightest atoms in the world. To him, nothing would be uncertain, The future, as well as the past, would be present to his eyes. Einstein admired this strict causality, calling it the profoundest characteristic of Newton's teaching. He wryly summarized the history of physics. In the beginning, if there was such a thing, God created Newton's laws of motion together with the necessary masses and forces. What especially impressed Einstein were the achievements of mechanics in areas that apparently had nothing to do with mechanics, such as the kinetic theory he had been exploring, which explained the behavior of gases as being caused by the actions of billions of molecules bumping around. In the mid-1800s, Newtonian mechanics was joined by another great advance. The English experimenter Michael Faraday, 1791 to 1867, the self-taught son of a blacksmith, discovered the properties of electrical and magnetic fields. He showed that an electric current produced magnetism, and then he showed that a changing magnetic field could produce an electric current. When a magnet is moved near a wire loop, or vice versa, an electric current is produced. Faraday's work on electromagnetic induction permitted inventive entrepreneurs like Einstein's father and uncle to create new ways of combining spinning wire coils and moving magnets to build electricity generators. As a result, young Albert Einstein had a profound physical feel for Faraday's fields, and not just a theoretical understanding of them. The bushy-bearded Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell, 1831 to 1879, subsequently devised wonderful equations that specified, among other things, how changing electric fields create magnetic fields, and how changing magnetic fields create electrical ones. A changing electric field could, in fact, produce a changing magnetic field that could, in turn, produce a changing electric field, and so on. The result of this coupling was an electromagnetic wave. Just as Newton had been born the year that Galileo died, so Einstein was born the year that Maxwell died, and he saw it as part of his mission to extend the work of the Scotsman. Here was a theorist who had shed prevailing biases, let mathematical melodies lead him into unknown territories, and found a harmony that was based on the beauty and simplicity of a field theory. All of his life, Einstein was fascinated by field theories, and he described the development of the concept in a textbook he wrote with a colleague. A new concept appeared in physics, the most important invention since Newton's time, the field. It needed great scientific imagination to realize that it is not the charges nor the particles, but the field in the space between the charges and the particles that is essential for the description of physical phenomena. The field concept proved successful when it led to the formulation of Maxwell's equations describing the structure of the electromagnetic field. At first, the electromagnetic field theory developed by Maxwell seemed compatible with the mechanics of Newton. For example, Maxwell believed that electromagnetic waves, which include visible light, could be explained by classical mechanics, if we assume that the universe is suffused with some unseen, gossamer, light-bearing ether that serves as the physical substance that undulates and oscillates to propagate the electromagnetic waves, comparable to the role water plays for ocean waves and air plays for sound waves. By the end of the 19th century, however, fissures had begun to develop in the foundations of classical physics. One problem was that scientists, as hard as they tried, could not find any evidence of our motion through this supposed light-propagating ether. The study of radiation, how light and other electromagnetic waves emanate from physical bodies, exposed another problem. Strange things were happening at the borderline where Newtonian theories, which described the mechanics of discrete particles, interacted with field theory, which described all electromagnetic phenomena. Up until then, Einstein had published 5 little-noted papers. They had earned him neither a doctorate nor a teaching job, even at a high school. Had he given up theoretical physics at that point, the scientific community would not have noticed, and he might have moved up the ladder to become the head of the Swiss Patent Office, a job in which he would likely have been very good indeed. There was no sign that he was about to unleash an annus mirabilis the like of which science had not seen since 1666, when Isaac Newton, holed up at his mother's home in rural Woolsthorpe to escape the plague that was devastating Cambridge, developed calculus, an analysis of the light spectrum, and the laws of gravity. But physics was poised to be upended again, and Einstein was poised to be the one to do it. He had the brashness needed to scrub away layers of conventional wisdom that were obscuring the cracks in the foundation of physics, and his visual imagination allowed him to make conceptual leaps that eluded more traditional thinkers. The breakthroughs that he wrought during a four-month frenzy from March to June 1905 were heralded in what would become one of the most famous personal letters in the history of science. Conrad Habicht, his fellow philosophical frolicker in the Olympia Academy, had just moved away from Bern, which, happily for historians, gave a reason for Einstein to write to him in late May. "Dear Habicht, such a solemn air of silence has descended between us that I almost feel as if I am committing a sacrilege when I break it now with some inconsequential babble. So what are you up to, you frozen whale, you smoked, dried, canned piece of soul? Why have you still not sent me your dissertation? Don't you know that I am one of the 1.5 fellows who would read it with interest and pleasure, you wretched man? I promise you 4 papers in return. The first deals with radiation and the energy properties of light, and is very revolutionary, as you will see, if you send me your work first. The second paper is a determination of the true sizes of atoms. The third proves that bodies on the order of magnitude of 1/1000th millimeter, suspended in liquids, must already perform an observable random motion that is produced by thermal motion. Such movement of suspended bodies has actually been observed by physiologists who call it Brownian molecular motion. The fourth paper is only a rough draft at this point, and is an electrodynamics of moving bodies which employs a modification of the theory of space and time. Light quanta, March 1905. As Einstein noted to Habicht, it was the first of these 1905 papers, not the famous final one expounding a theory of relativity, that deserved the designation revolutionary. Indeed, it may contain the most revolutionary development in the history of physics. Its suggestion that light comes not just in waves but in tiny packets, quanta of light that were later dubbed photons, spirits us into strange scientific mists that are far murkier, indeed more spooky, than even the weirdest aspects of the theory of relativity. Einstein recognized this in the slightly odd title he gave to the paper, which he submitted on March 17, 1905, to the Annalen der Physik. On a heuristic point of view concerning the production and transformation of light. Heuristic? It means a hypothesis that serves as a guide and gives direction in solving a problem, but is not considered proven. From this first sentence he ever published about quantum theory until his last such sentence, which came in a paper exactly 50 years later, just before he died, Einstein regarded the concept of the quanta and all of its unsettling implications as heuristic at best, provisional and incomplete, and not fully compatible with his own intimations of underlying reality. At the heart of Einstein's paper were questions that were bedeviling physics at the turn of the century, and in fact have done so from the time of the ancient Greeks until today. Is the universe made up of particles, such as atoms and electrons, or is it an unbroken continuum, as a gravitational or electromagnetic field seems to be? And if both methods of describing things are valid at times, what happens when they intersect? Since the 1860s, scientists had been exploring just such a point of intersection by analyzing what was called black body radiation. As anyone who has played with a kiln or a gas burner knows, the glow from a material such as iron changes color as it heats up. First, it appears to radiate mainly red light. As it gets hotter, it glows more orange, and then white, and then blue. To study this radiation, Gustav Kirchhoff and others devised a closed metal container with a tiny hole to let a little light escape. Then they drew a graph of the intensity of each wavelength when the device reached equilibrium at a certain temperature. No matter what the material or shape of the container's walls, the results were the same. The shape of the graphs depended only on the temperature. There was, alas, a problem. No one could fully account for the basis of the mathematical formula that would produce the hill-like shape of these graphs. When Kirchhoff died, his professorship at the University of Berlin was given to Max Planck. Born in 1858 into an ancient German family of great scholars, theologians, and lawyers, Planck was many things that Einstein was not. With his pince-nez glasses and meticulous dress, he was very proudly German, somewhat shy, steely in his resolve, conservative by instinct, and formal in his manner. It is difficult to imagine two men of more different attitudes, their mutual friend Max Born later said. Einstein, a citizen of the whole world, little attached to the people around him, independent of the emotional background of the society in which he lived. Planck, deeply rooted in the traditions of his family and nation, an ardent patriot, proud of the greatness of German history, and consciously Prussian in his attitude to the state. His conservatism made Planck skeptical about the atom, and of particle, rather than wave and continuous field theories in general. As he wrote in 1882, "Despite the great success that the atomic theory has so far enjoyed, ultimately it will have to be abandoned in favor of the assumption of continuous matter." In one of our planet's little ironies, Planck and Einstein would share the fate of laying the groundwork for quantum mechanics, and then both would flinch when it became clear that it undermined the concepts of strict causality and certainty they both worshipped. In 1900, Planck came up with an equation, partly using what he called a fortuitous guess, that described the curve of radiation wavelengths at each temperature. In so doing, he accepted that Boltzmann's statistical methods, which he had resisted, were correct after all. But the equation had an odd feature. It required the use of a constant, which was an unexplained tiny quantity, approximately 6.62607 times 10 to the minus 34 joule seconds, that needed to be included for it to come out right. It was soon dubbed Planck's constant, H, and is now known as one of the fundamental constants of nature. At first, Planck had no idea what, if any, physical meaning this mathematical constant had, but then he came up with a theory that, he thought, applied not to the nature of light itself, but to the action that occurred when the light was absorbed or emitted by a piece of matter. He posited that the surface of anything that was radiating heat and light, such as the walls in a blackbody device, contained vibrating molecules, or harmonic oscillators, like little vibrating springs. These harmonic oscillators could absorb or emit energy only in the form of discrete packets or bundles. These packets or bundles of energy came only in fixed amounts, determined by Planck's constant, rather than being divisible or having a continuous range of values. Planck considered his constant a mere calculational contrivance that explained the process of emitting or absorbing light, but did not apply to the fundamental nature of light itself. Nevertheless, the declaration he made to the Berlin Physical Society in December 1900 was momentous. "We therefore regard, and this is the most essential point of the entire calculation, energy to be composed of a very definite number of equal, finite packages." Einstein quickly realized that quantum theory could undermine classical physics. "All of this was quite clear to me shortly after the appearance of Planck's fundamental work," he wrote later. "All of my attempts to adapt the theoretical foundation of physics to this knowledge failed completely. It was as if the ground had been pulled out from under us, with no firm foundation to be seen anywhere." In addition to the problem of explaining what Planck's constant was really all about, there was another curiosity about radiation that needed to be explained. It was called the photoelectric effect, and it occurs when light shining on a metal surface causes electrons to be knocked loose and emitted. In the letter he wrote to Marich right after he learned of her pregnancy in May 1901, Einstein enthused over a beautiful piece by Philip Lenard that explored this topic. Lenard's experiment found something unexpected. When he increased the frequency of the light, moving from infrared heat and red light, up in frequency to violet and ultraviolet, the emitted electrons sped out with much more energy. Then he increased the intensity of the light by using a carbon arc light that could be made brighter by a factor of 1,000. The brighter, more intense light had a lot more energy, so it seemed logical that the electrons emitted would have more energy and speed away faster. But that did not occur. More intense light produced more electrons, but the energy of each remained the same. This was something that the wave theory of light did not explain. Einstein had been pondering the work of Planck and Lenard for 4 years. In his final paper of 1904, on the general molecular theory of heat, he discussed how the average energy of a system of molecules fluctuates. He then applied this to a volume filled with radiation and found that experimental results were comparable. His concluding phrase was, "I believe that this agreement must not be ascribed to chance." As he wrote to his friend Conrad Habicht just after finishing that 1904 paper, "I have now found in a most simple way the relation between the size of elementary quanta of matter and the wavelengths of radiation." He was thus primed, so it seems, to form a theory that the radiation field was made up of quanta. In his 1905 light quanta paper, published a year later, he did just that. He took the mathematical quirk that Planck had discovered, interpreted it literally, related it to Lenard's photoelectric results, and analyzed light as if it really was made up of point-like particles, light quanta, he called them, rather than being a continuous wave. Einstein began his paper by describing the great distinction between theories based on particles, such as the kinetic theory of gases, and theories that involve continuous functions, such as the electromagnetic fields of the wave theory of light. There exists a profound formal difference between the theories that physicists have formed about gases and other ponderable bodies and Maxwell's theory of electromagnetic processes in so-called empty space, he noted. While we consider the state of a body to be completely determined by the positions and velocities of a very large, yet finite, number of atoms and electrons, we make use of continuous spatial functions to describe the electromagnetic state of a given volume. Before he made his case for a particle theory of light, he emphasized that this would not make it necessary to scrap the wave theory, which would continue to be useful as well. The wave theory of light, which operates with continuous spatial functions, has worked well in the representation of purely optical phenomena, and will probably never be replaced by another theory. His way of accommodating both a wave theory and a particle theory was to suggest, in a heuristic way, that our observation of waves involves statistical averages of the positions of what could be countless particles. It should be kept in mind, he said, that the optical observations refer to time averages rather than instantaneous values. Then came what may be the most revolutionary sentence that Einstein ever wrote. It suggests that light is made up of discrete particles or packets of energy. According to the assumption to be considered here, when a light ray is propagated from a point, the energy is not continuously distributed over an increasing space, but consists of a finite number of energy quanta, which are localized at points in space, and which can be produced and absorbed only as complete units. Einstein explored this hypothesis by determining whether a volume of blackbody radiation, which he was now assuming consisted of discrete quanta, might in fact behave like a volume of gas, which he knew consisted of discrete particles. First, he looked at the formulas that showed how the entropy of a gas changes when its volume changes. Then he compared this to how the entropy of blackbody radiation changes as its volume changes. He found that the entropy of the radiation varies with volume according to the same law as the entropy of an ideal gas. He did a calculation using Boltzmann's statistical formulas for entropy. The statistical mechanics that described a dilute gas of particles was mathematically the same as that for blackbody radiation. This led Einstein to declare that the radiation behaves thermodynamically as if it consisted of mutually independent energy quanta. It also provided a way to calculate the energy of a particle of light at a particular frequency, which turned out to be in accord with what Planck had found. Einstein went on to show how the existence of these light quanta could explain what he graciously called Lenard's pioneering work on the photoelectric effect. If light came in discrete quanta, then the energy of each one was determined simply by the frequency of the light multiplied by Planck's constant. If we assume, Einstein suggested, that a light quantum transfers its entire energy to a single electron, then it follows that light of a higher frequency would cause the electrons to emit with more energy. On the other hand, increasing the intensity of the light, but not the frequency, would simply mean that more electrons would be emitted, but the energy of each would be the same. That was precisely what Lenard had found. With a trace of humility or tentativeness, along with a desire to show that his conclusions had been deduced theoretically rather than induced entirely from experimental data, Einstein declared of his paper's premise that light consists of tiny quanta, "As far as I can see, our conception does not conflict with the properties of the photoelectric effect observed by Mr. Leonard." By blowing on Planck's embers, Einstein had turned them into a flame that would consume classical physics. What precisely did Einstein produce that made his 1905 paper a discontinuous, one is tempted to say quantum, leap beyond the work of Planck? In effect, as Einstein noted in a paper the following year, his role was that he figured out the physical significance of what Planck had discovered. For Planck, a reluctant revolutionary, the quantum was a mathematical contrivance that explained how energy was emitted and absorbed when it interacted with matter. But he did not see that it related to a physical reality that was inherent in the nature of light and the electromagnetic field itself. One can interpret Planck's 1900 paper to mean only that the quantum hypothesis is used as a mathematical convenience introduced in order to calculate a statistical distribution, not as a new physical assumption, write science historians Gerald Holton and Stephen Brush. Einstein, on the other hand, considered the light quantum to be a feature of reality, a perplexing, pesky, mysterious, and sometimes maddening quirk in the cosmos. For him, these quanta of energy, which in 1926 were named photons, existed even when light was moving through a vacuum. We wish to show that Mr. Planck's determination of the elementary quanta is to some extent independent of his theory of blackbody radiation, he wrote. In other words, Einstein argued that the particulate or grainy nature of light was a property of the light itself, and not just some description of how the light interacts with matter. Even after Einstein published his paper, Planck did not accept his leap. 2 years later, Planck warned the young patent clerk that he had gone too far and that quanta described a process that occurred during emission or absorption rather than some real property of radiation in a vacuum. "I do not seek the meaning of the quantum of action, light quantum, in the vacuum, but at the site of absorption and emission," he advised. Planck's resistance to believing that the light quanta had a physical reality persisted. 8 years after Einstein's paper was published, Planck proposed him for a coveted seat in the Prussian Academy of Sciences. The letter he and other supporters wrote was filled with praise, but Planck added that he might sometimes have overshot the target in his speculations, as, for example, in his light quantum hypothesis, should not be counted against him too much. Just before he died, Planck reflected on the fact that he had long recoiled from the implications of his discovery. "My futile attempts to fit the elementary quantum of action somehow into classical theory continued for a number of years and cost me a great deal of effort," he wrote. "Many of my colleagues saw in this something bordering on a tragedy." Ironically, similar words would later be used to describe Einstein. "He became increasingly aloof and skeptical about the quantum discoveries he pioneered," Born said of Einstein. "Many of us regard this as a tragedy." Einstein's theory produced a law of the photoelectric effect that was experimentally testable. The energy of emitted electrons would depend on the frequency of the light according to a simple mathematical formula involving Planck's constant. The formula was subsequently shown to be correct. The physicist who did the crucial experiment was Robert Millikan, who would later head the California Institute of Technology and try to recruit Einstein. Yet even after he verified Einstein's photoelectric formulas, Millikan still rejected the theory. "Despite the apparently complete success of the Einstein equation," he declared, "the physical theory on which it was designed to be the symbolic expression is found so untenable that Einstein himself, I believe, no longer holds to it." Millikan was wrong to say that Einstein's formulation of the photoelectric effect had been abandoned. In fact, it was specifically for discovering the law of the photoelectric effect that Einstein would win his only Nobel Prize. With the advent of quantum mechanics in the 1920s, the reality of the photon became a fundamental part of physics. However, on the larger point, Millikan was right. Einstein would increasingly find the eerie implications of the quantum and of the wave-particle duality of light to be deeply unsettling. In a letter he wrote near the end of his life to his dear friend Michele Besso, after quantum mechanics had been accepted by almost every living physicist, Einstein would lament, "All these 50 years of pondering have not brought me any closer to answering the question, what are light quanta?" Doctoral dissertation on the size of molecules, April 1905. Einstein had written a paper that would revolutionize science, but he had not yet been able to earn a doctorate. So he tried one more time to get a dissertation accepted. He realized that he needed a safe topic, not a radical one like quanta or relativity, so he chose the second paper he was working on, titled A New Determination of Molecular Dimensions, which he completed on April 30th and submitted to the University of Zurich in July. Perhaps out of caution and deference to the conservative approach of his advisor Alfred Kleiner, he generally avoided the innovative statistical physics featured in his previous papers and in his Brownian motion paper completed 11 days later, and relied instead mainly on classical hydrodynamics. Yet he was still able to explore how the behavior of countless tiny particles, atoms, molecules, are reflected in observable phenomena, and conversely, how observable phenomena can tell us about the nature of those tiny unseen particles. Almost a century earlier, the Italian scientist Amedeo Avogadro, 1776 to 1856, had developed the hypothesis, correct as it turned out, that equal volumes of any gas, when measured at the same temperature and pressure, will have the same number of molecules. That led to a difficult quest, figuring out just how many this was. The volume usually chosen is that occupied by a mole of the gas, its molecular weight in grams, which is 22.4 liters at standard temperature and pressure. The number of molecules under such conditions later became known as Avogadro's number. Determining it precisely was, and still is, rather difficult. A current estimate is approximately 6.02214 times 10 to the 23rd. This is a big number. That many unpopped popcorn kernels, when spread across the United States, would cover the country 9 miles deep. Most previous measurements of molecules had been done by studying gases. But as Einstein noted in the first sentence of his paper, the physical phenomena observed in liquids have thus far not served for the determination of molecular sizes. In this dissertation, after a few math and data corrections were later made, Einstein was the first person able to get a respectable result using liquids. His method involved making use of data about viscosity, which is how much resistance a liquid offers to an object that tries to move through it. Tar and molasses, for example, are highly viscous. If you dissolve sugar in water, the solution's viscosity increases as it gets more syrupy. Einstein envisioned the sugar molecules gradually diffusing their way through the smaller water molecules. He was able to come up with two equations, each containing the two unknown variables, the size of the sugar molecules and the number of them in the water, that he was trying to determine. He could then solve for these unknown variables. Doing so, he got a result for Avogadro's number that was 2.1 times 10 to the 23rd. That, unfortunately, was not very close. When he submitted his paper to the Annalen der Physik in August, right after it had been accepted by Zurich University, the editor, Paul Drude, who was blissfully unaware of Einstein's earlier desire to ridicule him, held up its publication because he knew of some better data on the properties of sugar solutions. Using this new data, Einstein came up with a result that was closer to correct, 4.15 times 10 to the 23rd. A few years later, a French student tested the approach experimentally and discovered something amiss. So Einstein asked an assistant in Zurich to look at it all over again. He found a minor error, which, when corrected, produced a result of 6.56 times 10 to the 23rd, which ended up being quite respectable. Einstein later said, perhaps half-jokingly, that when he submitted his thesis, Professor Kleiner rejected it for being too short, so he added one more sentence, and it was promptly accepted. There is no documentary evidence for this. Either way, his thesis actually became one of his most cited and practically useful papers, with applications in such diverse fields as cement mixing, dairy production, and aerosol products. And even though it did not help him get an academic job, it did make it possible for him to become known, finally, as Dr. Einstein. Brownian Motion, May 1905. 11 days after finishing his dissertation, Einstein produced another paper exploring evidence of things unseen. As he had been doing since 1901, he relied on statistical analysis of the random actions of invisible particles to show how they were reflected in the visible world. In doing so, Einstein explained a phenomenon known as Brownian motion that had been puzzling scientists for almost 80 years. Why small particles suspended in a liquid such as water are observed to jiggle around. And as a byproduct, he pretty much settled once and for all that atoms and molecules actually existed as physical objects. Brownian motion was named after the Scottish botanist Robert Brown, who in 1828 had published detailed observations about how minuscule pollen particles suspended in water can be seen to wiggle and wander when examined under a strong microscope. The study was replicated with other particles, including filings from the Sphinx, and a variety of explanations was offered. Perhaps it had something to do with tiny water currents or the effect of light, but none of these theories proved plausible. With the rise in the 1870s of the kinetic theory, which used the random motions of molecules to explain things like the behavior of gases, some tried to use it to explain Brownian motion. But because the suspended particles were 10,000 times larger than a water molecule, it seemed that a molecule would not have the power to budge the particle, any more than a